The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
President Trump will not say if he'll step down peacefully if he loses in November. A retired general says his colleagues in Europe don't like that kind of talk.
And they are, I'll use the word, disgusted at what they're seeing.
Also today, if Switzerland is a neutral country, does it need a new air force? Swiss voters face that question this weekend.
We do not need 30 to 40 fighter jets. We just need to respond to the risks that are at stake right now in Switzerland.
And you can legally fish off the Galapagos Islands.
This fishing is occurring in an area that belongs to no other nation.
But marine conservationists say China is overdoing it. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World, and you made it to Friday. A week that saw American democracy take a hit. The peaceful transition of power is one of the pillars of democracy. So this exchange 2 days ago between President Trump and reporter Brian Karam with Playboy magazine ruffled a lot of feathers.
Will you commit to making sure that there is a peaceful transfer of power after the election?
Well, we're going to have to see what happens. You know that I've been complaining very strongly.
Not committing to a peaceful transfer of power. The president's refusal to defend that concept brought swift rebukes, a chorus of voices saying this does not happen in America. Retired U.S. Army General Mark Hertling is with me. General Hertling, you served 37 years in the U.S. Army. You commanded troops in Iraq with the intent of bringing democracy there. So you've witnessed peaceful as well as non-peaceful transfers of power. What was your reaction when you heard Trump's remarks?
There was quite a bit of agony in it, Marco. Truthfully, when you've sworn your life to defend the Constitution and the kinds of ideas that are embedded in that wonderful document, really the essence of our representative democracy is voting for the people we want to represent us. To have President Trump say that was really discouraging and somewhat vile.
Well, we wanted specifically to speak with you because you have witnessed moments in history where a peaceful transfer of power is not guaranteed. For example, in Iraq, you were there, General, during the 2005 elections. How did you work with leaders there to promote a peaceful transition, and what were the results of your work?
Yeah, I was there in 2003 and 2004, and we were beginning the preparation for the elections. And it was fascinating to me because I was back in Germany during the actual first elections themselves in 2005. And truthfully, Marco, I became very emotional watching it because I know the preparations that took place in order to prepare the Iraqi people to do things. Now, they had some problems in that very first elections. A lot of Sunni tribal members boycotted those elections because they felt they were going to be unfair. And then they realized after the election how the only way you can get the kind of leaders that you need are by voting. And in fact, I'll even tell you a story. When I went back to Iraq in 2007, I had a subordinate commander who said, hey, you got to come down to my area of operations and meet a guy who wants to transition from being an insurgent into going to school at the University of Baghdad and learning political science so he can someday be a representative of the Iraqi government. So I went down to this small village, met this guy. His name was Ahmed. I said, what made you decide to become involved in going back to school and being a politician? And he was a young guy. And he said to me, he lifted up his finger and he said, I learned that the power of the finger was greater than the power of the gun. And what he was talking about is, you recall, in Iraq during that period, voters would have to dip their finger into a bottle of ink to prove that they had voted and they had only voted once. And what he was saying is that power of a representative government displaced the fighting that they had seen so much of in Iraq. It was a highly emotional moment for me to see this young man saying that he wanted to be part of the solution as opposed to part of the problem. Right now, with our president saying the kinds of things he's saying now, it appears that he's trying to divide people and push more of the problems as opposed to the solutions upon the American society.
When people hear about leaders refusing to hand over power, most people don't think of the U.S., but now there's this doubt. So if the U.S. fails to have a peaceful transition of power, what message does that send to the rest of the globe?
Well, I'm an optimist in this regard, and I believe our institutions will weather this storm, and they will, in fact, hold up and ensure a peaceful transition of power.
What makes you so confident?
Well, because I think our other institutions, our courts, our states, they certainly couldn't stand up to the will of the people, just like we're seeing in Belarus today and what's happening in Minsk. Once the people realize that there's crookedness within government, they will react on a much larger scale than even we've seen lately.
What if President Trump loses and refuses to leave? What happens then?
There is this vision by many Americans about when is the military going to step in and escort him out. That is not the job of the military. That's what happens in a dictatorial regime or an authoritarian regime. We have processes. If the president refuses to leave the White House, there are both overt and covert ways to affect his departure. But I don't ever see a march of the military, because they would then become a fourth arm of government. And that's contrary to our Constitution as well.
General, you've made your criticisms of Trump and your support for Joe Biden quite clear over time. And we hear this week from General H.R. McMaster, Trump's former national security advisor. He said this week that he will not become involved with politics because, quote, the military is apolitical and nonpartisan. What do you say to McMaster about that?
Well, I would say that under normal circumstances, that is absolutely true. And truthfully, Marco, I've been conflicted, as many of my colleagues have, about standing up. This isn't just partisan politics. This isn't standing up for a candidate. We have crossed the Rubicon into an area where we are standing up for our nation. This isn't about who gets elected. This is about the continuation of our body politic and a defense of who we are as a people. That's the difference between now and what has happened in the past. And truthfully, Marco, I relish the thought of getting back to the time when retirees and members of the military can say that they're nonpartisan. But in this case, it has nothing to do with partisan politics. It has to do with the defense of the Constitution.
General Mark Hertling, retired. He served in the U.S. Army for 37 years, most recently as commanding general of the U.S. Army Europe. Thank you very much for your time today and for explaining this.
Thank you, Marco. Appreciate it.
Once again, Paris is on edge. And once again, the focus is at the offices of the satirical political magazine Charlie Hebdo. Today, a man stabbed two people in front of that building, although the staff of the magazine have not worked there since January 2015. That's when Islamic extremists attacked the cartoonists and killed 17 people. Whether today's stabbings had anything to do with Charlie Hebdo is not yet clear. The attacks did occur against the backdrop of an ongoing trial in Paris, precisely around the 2015 violence at the magazine. 14 people, including three fugitives, are accused of helping the 2015 attackers. Reporter Rebecca Rossman is in Paris. What do we know, Rebecca, about the circumstances of today's stabbings? What happened?
So at around noon, an assailant came with what witnesses kind of describe as what looked like a butcher's knife. And he started attacking two people in front of the former Charlie Hebdo headquarters, a man and a woman, as they were having a cigarette. He quickly fled the scene, but he was arrested quite soon after, about an hour later. A second man is also in custody on suspicion of having collaborated with the primary suspect. I should also note that both the victims, while they're being treated for serious injuries, the Prime Minister, Jean Castex, has said that their injuries are not life-threatening. They both work for a media production company which took over the former offices after, as you mentioned, Charlie Hebdo left after the 2015 attacks.
Do we know anything about the two suspects at this point?
There was some information that was released. The Paris prosecutor's office has asked people not to discuss that information because it is an ongoing investigation, and we're waiting for more information to come directly from them.
French officials say they're considering charges of attempted murder related to a terrorist enterprise, as well as conspiracy with terrorists. What's behind those charges?
So they've opened up a terrorist investigation, and there's two reasons why they're doing that. The first reason is because of the location, right? This happened at the Charlie Hebdo's offices, former Charlie Hebdo offices. Obviously, there's a lot of symbolism around that. And it's happening also during a very high-profile trial of several people accused of helping the assailants in the 2015 attack. So while it's not confirmed, what prosecutors are saying is that they don't believe it's a coincidence.
Right. So there's this big trial underway in Paris in its third week, and it's centered on the 2015 attack on Charlie Hebdo. Who are the defendants in that trial? What role are they alleged to have had in the 2015 attack of the magazine?
It's 14 people, and they're believed to kind of played a collaboration role, helping the assailants when it comes to things like providing cars, providing weapons, basically mapping out how the attacks unfolded and providing equipment to them.
So earlier this month, just ahead of the trial, Charlie Hebdo republished some of the cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad that had so angered the extremists who attacked them in 2015. What was the reaction to that republication?
There was a strong reaction. There were immediately threats from Al-Qaeda. There were threats against Charlie Hebdo's human resources head. She recently received some very serious personal threats and has been forced to leave her home. But there's also been a backlash to that. So earlier this week, 100 French media organizations published an open letter in defense of freedom of the press, freedom of expression, particularly when it comes to Charlie Hebdo.
And the Charlie Hebdo contributors who survived the 2015 attack, they're at home or taking careful precautions not to be public about where they live, just lying low?
Yeah, I can't tell you where they live. They're definitely lying low. I can't even tell you where their new offices are. It's in an undisclosed location.
Right. They don't want anybody to know.
They don't want anybody to know.
Reporter Rebecca Rossman speaking with us from Paris. Rebecca, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Something sketchy happened off the coast of the Galapagos Islands this summer. That's according to marine conservation group Oceana. They confirmed the presence of a vast fleet of Chinese fishing vessels right next to the islands in July. Hundreds of boats fishing mostly for squid. Marla Valentine is an expert on illegal fishing and transparency for Oceana. Marla, Oceana's map of these fishing vessels shows them densely clustered right outside of Ecuador's waters. Was the fishing you detected illegal? Like, were there laws broken?
No, this fishing was not illegal, but there is a very fine line between what is legal and what is responsible and sustainable.
And so what did you see going on off the Galapagos Islands?
Well, we found approximately 300 Chinese fishing vessels, and these vessels conducted over 73,000 hours of fishing in a one-month time period. The fleet was primarily targeting squid, which is an essential component to the diet of many iconic species, from hammerhead sharks to fur seals to the tunas and billfishes that contribute to the local economy.
So the Chinese embassy in Ecuador, after being confronted by the Ecuadorian government, they said they would tighten the regulations on their fishing operations there. So what's happening? Do you feel confident that it will stop? Has it stopped?
It has not stopped. We are continuing to monitor the fleet, and they are still fishing along the borders of the Galapagos Islands, the waters of Ecuador, and the waters of Peru. And they're heading southward towards Chile. And it has become increasingly clear that Chinese commercial fishing interests are far-reaching and potentially have massive implications for global marine fisheries.
I know squid is popular food in China. Why are these Chinese fleets so far from home? Do they not have squid anymore? Have their waters been overfished?
Well, there is pervasive squid fishing throughout the world's oceans, both in the waters surrounding China and North Korea, but also there is a large squid population that moves along the coast of South America. And many of these vessels are doing what's called squid jigging. It's a really unique type of fishing that shines these just intensely bright lights at the ocean surface. And this lures squid close enough to the boat to be caught in nets or on lines just by the thousands.
You mentioned earlier, Marla, the fine line between legal and illegal when it comes to fishing. What makes enforcement around the laws around fishing so hard?
Well, this fishing is occurring in an area that belongs to no other nation. So it's nearly impossible to put in force any sort of regulation to stop this fishing from happening.
I mean, China tops the list of worst offenders in the world when it comes to illegal fishing. But there are other countries such as Russia, Indonesia, and Cambodia that are in on it. What can small countries like Ecuador actually do to stand up to big fishing powers?
Well, they can use tools like Global Fishing Watch to monitor the movements of these fleets. And when fleets are approaching their waters, they can put out a physical presence to both monitor and deter any illegal behaviors by these fleets.
Marla Valentine is an expert on illegal fishing with the marine conservation group Oceana. Thanks very much for explaining this, Marla.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Social media allows people anywhere in the world to reach an international audience lightning fast. 10 years ago, one queer couple learned that firsthand when they posted a YouTube video that turned into a global phenomenon. The World's Bianca Hillier picks up the thread from here. And a quick warning, her story references teen suicide. Please take care while listening.
This week marks the 10th anniversary of Dan Savage and Terry Miller uploading their first video to YouTube.
High school was bad.
People were really cruel to me. I was beat up, thrown against walls and lockers and windows.
In the grainy clip, Dan and Terry are sitting at a bar in Seattle, sharing stories about getting bullied for being gay. The couple was inspired to do so after a slew of LGBTQ teen suicides made headlines across the U.S. in 2010. Dan's advice came in three short words.
It gets better.
It gets better. A simple and earnest message to queer youth that went viral.
It gets better.
It gets better.
It can get better today.
I can promise you, it gets better.
1,000 people uploaded videos in the first week, including the Canadian YouTuber and megastar Gigi Gorgeous. So,
but just have it in the back of your mind that high school is not going to be forever. It gets better.
High-ranking politicians were also quick to lend their voices to the project.
Don't feel like you're in this by yourself. Things will get better.
Things do get better.
Things really will get better.
And it will get better for you.
A decade later, the It Gets Better project is home to 70,000 videos from LGBTQ people and allies. And it's gone global with a network across 18 countries, from Argentina to Austria to Greece, India, and Russia. Alex Rees heads up the UK group from London. He says It Gets Better celebrates how far the community has come, with each video being unique to that person's journey.
The ones that probably have the most impact are people just talking into their phones and kind of being really open and honest. It is quite powerful in a way that I think we probably lose in the noise of social media nowadays.
That storytelling is essential to Justin Tindall. He runs the nonprofit's education and global programming from Los Angeles.
There's something about our message. There's something about the way that we tell our stories that just seems to be, to a certain extent, universal. It resonates with people all over the world.
Around the world, key aspects of LGBTQ life have gotten better in the past 10 years. Since 2010, 20 countries have legalized same-sex marriage. 17 countries have legalized adoption by same-sex couples. And 26 countries have put in place workplace protections based on sexual orientation. But many queer people continue to face an uphill battle.
Poland has been called the worst country in the EU for LGBT rights.
The Philippines has deported a US Marine who was convicted of killing a transgender woman in 2014.
In Tanzania, gay and transgender people have gone into hiding.
The Trump administration completed a change, rolling back a policy that protected transgender patients from discrimination.
The range of issues facing LGBTQ communities in different countries is why Justin Tindall says having It Gets Better teams stationed around the world is key.
That's where we let our affiliates step in. They know the experience. They know what it's like to be an LGBTQ person in Russia. I wouldn't ever be audacious enough to go to someone in a country like Russia to say, hey, it gets better.
It's the queer people within those countries, he says, whose stories will hit home with the community.
And I'm going to support them in spreading that message.
The message doesn't resonate with everyone. One British band penned a song called It Gets Worse.
It gets worse, it gets worse, it gets worse.
The lyrics there are pointing to the power structure that exists within the queer community. Critics say it can be harder for marginalized or less enfranchised people to see a brighter future. Tindall says he knows the project doesn't resonate with everyone, But within the 70,000 videos inspired by the It Gets Better project, Tyndall hopes people can find someone like them to relate or look up to. Tyndall says It Gets Better doesn't mean it gets perfect.
We're not promising it's going to be better every day and every moment for the rest of your life. What we're saying is that things get better because you find a friend that you can confide in. It gets better when you find a community that you can feel accepted and included in. I think it's those little moments, truly, that make us realize that things can get better.
Tyndall hopes the It Gets Better project will be around for another 10 years, as long as there are stories to be told and queer youth who need to hear them. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
North Korea did something surprising today. Kim Jong-un has issued a rare apology in a statement to South Korea. "I am deeply sorry that an unexpected and unfortunate thing has happened in our territorial waters," said the North Korean leader. He was referring to an incident we told you about yesterday on the show. A South Korean government official, apparently trying to defect to the North, was killed at sea by the North Korean military. Sung-yoon Lee is a Korea expert with the Fletcher School at Tufts University. He does not see what Kim said as much of an apology.
This statement, yes, is far more conciliatory than what we're accustomed to. But in this message, there is no admission of having burnt the man.
South Korea says that after the North Koreans shot the victim 10 times, they then burned the body out of concern of a possible spread of COVID-19.
And North Korea is basically saying, you know, we're sorry it happened, but the guards did the right thing. They did what they had to do. But don't use confrontational and blasphemous language. So it's sort of a rebuke, like, know thy place, you know, while you're saying we're very sorry it happened.
Tensions between North and South Korea have been running very high in recent months. The question is, why would Kim Jong-un take this opportunity to offer some version of an apology?
To my mind, this is an ongoing act, great leader mind trick. Kim Jong-un may feel that we went too far to burn the body. Now a lot of people are pissed off at us. So let's send this message, act conciliatory. And now everyone's happy. They're very moved. People in South Korea, the government, peace is nigh and all these good things.
Another revelation came from a national security official in the South today. He said that South Korea's president Moon Jae-in had exchanged letters with Kim Jong-un earlier this month. And Kim wrote that he was hoping to improve North-South relations. Before we take a quick break, a little recommendation for your weekend listening. We've been regularly hosting a series of live conversations about the coronavirus pandemic, along with Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. This week, we spoke with healthy buildings expert Joe Allen about how safe is safe enough when it comes to reopening schools. We just dropped that discussion into the World's podcast feed. Download it now on your favorite podcast app. You're listening to The World. At London's Royal Festival Hall, a new season begins, the first opening since the coronavirus lockdown. And composers of color want audiences to understand classical music has a diversity problem.
What I'm trying to get across is the sense of unease that I think we're all feeling at the moment.
What classical music can do for racial justice. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. On Sunday evening and Monday, Jews across the world will mark Yom Kippur, the holiest day on the Jewish calendar, the Day of Atonement, a time for introspection and forgiveness. In Israel, people will not be gathering in synagogues. Israel is going back into lockdown. Israelis were already under strict restrictions. Then new coronavirus cases spiked this week, 18,000 in 3 days. Professor Yuval Shani is the vice president of the Israel Democracy Institute. Professor Shani, I thought Israel was already in a lockdown. So is there a lockdown within a lockdown? What's going on?
Yeah, apparently. So Israel has been in a state of lockdown, but the restrictions that were imposed were not full restrictions. So the private sector was still operating. And the government decided yesterday to remove that exemption and go into a full lockdown, closing essentially almost all private businesses, and also introducing further restrictions on the ability to congregate and assemble in a variety of places and contexts.
Mm, and that starts when, tonight?
Yeah, 2 p.m. actually on Friday, Israeli time, some of the restrictions entered. And so have some of the congregation restrictions, yes.
So on the holiest day in the Jewish calendar, when everyone is trying to go to temple, does this mean this year synagogues are going to be closed on Yom Kippur?
The new regulations that have been promulgated do require synagogues to shut down in the next 2 weeks. And any prayer gatherings can take place, but only in open space, in clusters of no more than 20 individuals. For Yom Kippur itself, there has been a specific formula that had been introduced that allows a very small number of worshippers to enter synagogues, especially in light of the inability of more elderly people to actually spend time praying outside. It's going to be a very hot day, Yom Kippur.
Mm.
But many synagogues have already announced that they will not open, and many municipalities have also announced that they will not allow the opening of synagogues.
So a Yom Kippur with umbrellas to protect against the sun. So one thing that's really interesting that's come up in recent days in Israel has been the question of protests versus prayers. Religious leaders in Israel have complained about closing synagogues while protests are permitted. These continuing protests against Prime Minister Netanyahu, who's facing corruption charges. What do you make of that tension?
There was a very significant discourse in Israel as to what should be the relationship between competing basic rights, the right to assemble and protest on the one hand, and the right to worship or exercise freedom of religion on the other hand. I mean, the prime minister, who is, of course, the target of the protest, has in a way stoked this tension to some extent. And some even say that he has pushed for a more extreme lockdown so as to give him some more legitimacy in trying also to introduce stricter restrictions on the protests.
How significant would it be that the Israeli government bars protests against it, even during a time of crisis?
Well, this is going to be, I think, a very serious mistake and a very problematic development. I think there has been more a sense that in terms of enforcing other restrictions, the fact that you have this exception where a thousand, sometimes tens of thousands of people are congregating, this makes it a very difficult message to convey to the Israeli public that strict restrictions are needed. But of course, from a basic rights perspective, it's a very troubling development because you do not deprive basic rights in order to teach a lesson or to convey a message.
So bad communication, a lockdown within a lockdown, fast-changing and often confusing limitations, and this galloping infection rate in Israel, has there been an impact on trust between Israelis and their government?
Yeah, I mean, trust in government has been really in freefall. In the first wave, there has been the government was caught blinded and by this development, and they reacted quite quickly and efficiently. In the second wave, they had a lot of time to prepare, but they did not prepare adequately. They didn't prepare in a testing apparatus. The contact tracing apparatus is still not up and running. So there has been a lot of political infighting and foot dragging by Netanyahu and the government. So when we in the IDI started to track in this crisis his approval rating or trust, we were at around 60% trust. Now it is less than 30% trust.
Wow.
So his popularity has really gone down. And I think that's a general sense that the government is very unpopular.
Yom Kippur, of course, is dedicated to soul-searching, focusing on your shortcomings and how to change. And in a press conference last night, Prime Minister Netanyahu pretty much blamed Israelis for the current situation without taking any personal responsibility.
Itoreru. Enough is enough. Anachu b'mtziut acheret.
Switching between Hebrew and English there, Netanyahu was saying, wake up, we're in a severe crisis in Hebrew. Yuval Shani, how on board are Israelis with their prime minister with these new measures his government is imposing, also pointing the finger at the people? I mean, is anyone raising the spirit of Yom Kippur and how Netanyahu with comments like that is not exactly embracing forgiveness?
Yeah, I mean, he was subject to considerable criticism in Israel by other politicians and also by the press about the complete lack of soul searching on his part and his tendency to blame everyone else but himself. So I think this is really fueling in the problem of trust that we were discussing before. I mean, the prime minister seems to be on a very different trajectory from large parts of the nation. And I think this only deepens the political and health crisis that we are confronting.
Professor Yuval Shani is the vice president of the Israel Democracy Institute. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
The influence of China. Pretty much wherever you go in Southeast Asia, you can see how China asserts itself. New train lines, pipelines, ports, all built and financed by the Chinese government. China says it's a win-win for Beijing and for its neighbors. China expands its trading routes and other countries get badly needed infrastructure. But where do you draw the line between helping out a neighbor and simply taking over? Here's the world's Patrick Nguyen.
Sabaidi. That's how you say hello in Laos, a mountainous country between Thailand and Vietnam. Laos also shares a border with China. And in this video, put out by a Chinese state-run company, Laotian kids are saying hello to Chinese engineers in hard hats who are building a new train line. The kids bow and dance. It's all PR. And the message is, Chinese development is this happy, smiley thing. But when the kids go home, it sounds more like this. Cranes scooping dirt in the jungle and chainsaws mowing down trees. China is building so many projects in Laos that it's hard to keep track. Highways, power plants, dams, and none of it's free. Each mega project puts Laos deeper into debt. To stave off more debt, Laos is now letting a Chinese state-run firm take majority control of its entire electrical grid. That leaves the country in a very vulnerable position, says Lei Hong Hiep, a scholar with the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies.
If you allow a foreign country to control your national grid, that will be a serious problem. If any happens to the national grid, for example, the whole country will be blacked out.
Imagine, he says, if they turned off the lights, factories, military bases, whole cities just bam, in the dark.
That's something very worrying. And if that trend continues, I think Laos will definitely become the next victim of China's debt trap.
China's debt trap. It's a bit controversial, but the idea is China goes into a country like Laos or Sri Lanka or Cambodia, builds lots of stuff, and forces them into debt, sort of like a loan shark. The government can't pay China back, so they end up selling off pieces of the country. At the very least, Hiep says, Laos is placing a lot of trust in its superpower neighbor.
For Laos, they value development over security. They don't feel that they have big security problems with China.
Others feel differently. They say fears of Chinese control in a country like Laos, a worry that's shared among many Western analysts, are a bit overblown.
It is very easy for people who do not know much about Laos or other countries in Asia just criticize, well, China is a bad guy. But that is too simple. It's not that simple.
That's Toshiro Nishizawa from the University of Tokyo. He has worked as a policy advisor to Laos, to the government, and he says, look, China having sway over this small neighbor, it's just inevitable. Laos is landlocked. There are only 7 million Lao people. Most are farmers, and its entire national economy is smaller than that of Mobile, Alabama. China, on the other hand, will soon have the biggest economy on earth. And its officials aren't reckless, Nishizawa says. They don't want to go into Laos and just cut off the lights.
It is costly. What is the benefit, economic benefit for China to take such risk? Maybe China's approach is more pragmatic.
He says China wants the electrical grid in Laos to be a money maker. The idea is for Laos, with all of its hydro dams, to be like a battery for neighboring countries, selling electricity. Right now, it's a battery with a short extension cord. It needs more power lines reaching over its borders, and China has the cash and know-how to build them. Nishizawa says that's what this deal is really all about. Professor Hiep, though more skeptical of China, does concede that there aren't many other countries rushing in to develop Laos.
One problem for these countries is that there are not many options for them. The U.S. is not offering this kind of loans and economic assistance.
Right. America says China is a loan shark, but it is not offering much of an alternative. In fact, the last time the U.S. was really focused on Laos was the 1960s, and it went like this. Trying to stop Laos from being a communist state, the U.S. bombed the country so brutally that it remains, per capita, the most bombed nation in world history. And it didn't even work. Laos is run by, you guessed it, communists. And the American bombing campaign is one reason Laos is still a poor nation. Before that, Laos was colonized by the French, so for more than a century, it's been pushed around by different empires. Nishizawa says, because of that history, Lao officials really do worry about their autonomy and all this debt, which is now nearly 70% of its GDP, most of it owed to, yep, China.
They want to change the course of action, but projects are ongoing. No one can stop it. It's already ongoing.
Big infrastructure projects take years to build. The deals are done. The debt is there. And during the COVID-19 pandemic, with the Lao economy struggling, it's even harder to pay off loans in time. So Laos may not be thrilled that its power grid is in Chinese hands, but as they know all too well, it's not easy running a small country in the shadow of a superpower. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Switzerland is known for its neutrality. It has not fought a war in more than 200 years. But now Switzerland is planning to spend more than $6 billion to modernize its air force. It sparked a debate with many Swiss asking a simple question, who's our enemy? And is a new fleet of advanced fighter jets really necessary? This weekend, Swiss voters will weigh in on this. Thomas Bruchet is the political secretary of the Group for a Switzerland Without an Army. They're the group that forced the referendum, collecting more than 60,000 signatures, to let Swiss voters weigh in on the matter. Thomas, thanks for being here. The plan's meant to replace Switzerland's aging fleet of FA-18s, which will go out of service in about 10 years. Why are you against replacing those?
The whole question is, what are the risks? What are the threats to the security of the population right now in Switzerland? And our answer is to say that the major risks right now are pandemics, like the one we're experiencing right now, the changes linked to the climate crisis, its consequences, of course, and also cyber risks. But like risks coming from the air are not realistic scenarios of risks, and thus we do not have to spend over $6 billion.
The Swiss Air Force, it goes back to the advent of aviation in the early 1900s. The cost of buying new aircraft have often been subject to controversy. I looked at the history. I saw that in 93, voters endorsed the purchase of the current FA-18 fleet. But then some 20 years later, voters said no and rejected the purchase of Swedish fighter jets. That suggests the Swiss have changed their minds over the years on this. But why is this such a controversial issue for the Swiss?
I think that's really a debate that goes deeper than that, because in Switzerland, the army has been a debate for a lot of years. It was coming from our group, an initiative, a proposition of abolishing the Swiss army. So it's really a thing about 30 years. And these fighter jets are really the expression of wanting a Switzerland with a well-equipped army, etc. And we're really against it. So it's really kind of the incarnation of that whole debate.
Hmm. So while your country is entirely surrounded by NATO countries, do you really believe that a country can last without a standing army?
That's the whole debate, really, about like the realistic scenarios of an attack of Switzerland. That's not realistic. That's what we're saying, because you can just imagine two cases. The first would be we would be attacked by one of the neighbor countries, and that would be a country from the NATO, and so we are lost anyway. Or the attack comes from outside. And that would mean that the country that is attacking Switzerland would have won against these countries from the NATO. So anyway, we have no chance. So the whole thing is Switzerland is a small country, has a small army. We do not need 30 to 40 fighter jets. We just need to respond to the risks that are at stake right now in Switzerland. We need to protect the population, and to protect the population, we need to respond to pandemics. We need to respond to the climate crisis.
This coming Sunday's referendum, Thomas, was forced by your group after collecting more than 60,000 signatures, as I said. Why do you think the people are the ones who should decide on this and not the political representatives?
Of course, it's maybe hard to understand for people outside Switzerland, but it's really like the way we proceed in Switzerland. If there's like a law that is heavily criticized inside the population, which is the case for fighter jets. The population needs to have the opportunity to decide on it. And for a lot of groups, because it's not only our group, but a lot of associations, a lot of also left parties, it's just unacceptable to proceed like that. Switzerland is a country also known for its engagement for peace in the world, and we need to work more on this issue more than just thinking about protect ourselves against risks that do not exist.
Thomas, do you think the Swiss will vote on not funding the fighter jets on Sunday?
Right now, looking at the polls, it's more negative for us because the last poll said that 56% of the population would agree with the project. It's not a surprise because when all the right-wing parties are behind a project, it's really hard to defeat it. And Switzerland at a national level is really a right-wing country. So it's going to be really hard. But there are, of course, good arguments in favor of it. The experience we had with the pandemic is a good argument against these fighter jets. And of course, the experience of 2014, where the population refused new fighter jets, is also a reason to go on fighting till the last day.
Thomas Bruchet is the political secretary of the Group for a Switzerland Without an Army. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Lebanon is reeling. The economy is in a tailspin. Coronavirus cases are spiking. Politicians can't agree on how to form a new government. And Beirut is still dealing with the aftermath of that massive and deadly port explosion in August. Now some Lebanese are so desperate for a way out, they're paying smugglers to take them to Europe by ship. On Monday, we'll bring you the story of one of those risky boat journeys, one that ended tragically, after a crude attempt to send an SOS from sea.
We don't have fuel nor water. Someone come please and help us, save us.
The story of a Lebanese family that risked everything to get to Europe. That's Monday, here on The World. London's Royal Festival Hall is reopening with a new season of classical music, marking the first performances there since the start of the pandemic. The fall lineup is inspired by the Black Lives Matter protests. The featured music is written by 21 composers of color. Despite that focus, there's no getting away from the fact that classical music has a diversity problem. The World's Orla Barry sent us this report from London.
What did he see?
What did he see that prompted such rage? This composition is a tribute to Sandra Bland. She died in police custody in Texas in 2015, and it's one of the pieces chosen for the Royal Festival Hall's new season. Composer Courtney Brine says she felt driven to write it.
It was really affecting me personally in an overwhelming way. Just seeing videos of people being brutalized and hearing about the police getting off, so... Yeah, it was something I felt compelled to do more than something I was excited to do.
This has been a tough year for many musicians. Brian, who's from New Orleans, says between the pandemic and the Black Lives Matter protests, it's been a challenge to be creative.
All of 2020, I didn't write any music. And in 2019, I was just writing and writing. I was like pumping out music. But yeah, this year I didn't write a note until late August.
As the Black Lives Matter marches against police brutality spread around the world, one image came to define the protests in London.
We did what we had to do. We stopped somebody from being killed, basically.
Patrick Hutchinson was at a protest when he saw a white man, a counter-protester, on the ground surrounded by Black Lives Matter demonstrators.
I was just thinking of, you know, a human being on the floor. It wasn't going to end well had we not intervened. And that was it. I had no other thoughts in my mind apart from get him to safety.
The image of Hutchinson, who's black, carrying the white counter-protester over his shoulder and away from the crowd, went viral. The incident happened a stone's throw from the Royal Festival Hall, and it moved composer James B. Wilson and poet Yomi Sode to create a piece of music. Here's Wilson.
We're in unprecedented times with the pandemic and also the civil unrest and racial tension in America and in this country. What I'm trying to get across is the sense of unease that I think we're all feeling at the moment.
Wilson is more than aware that he's in the minority as a black British composer. As a student, he was the only black composer at his music academy that year, and says he often had to fight the feeling that he didn't belong.
when you mention to people that you're a composer, sometimes people will, you know, respond in disbelief. And you don't know if that's necessarily because of your race or how young you are or what the case may be. And there is always something in the back of your mind about, do I belong in this space?
Courtney Bryan says she faced discrimination too, although she didn't realise it at the time. As a music student in New Orleans, Bryan says her teachers advised her to seek guidance from one local composer.
When I reached out to him about studying with him, he refused to teach me. And he didn't say because you're black, but he said that I was a jazz composer, or I was jazz something, and that I'd be more suited to doing some of the whatever. He had some assumption, which was weird on a number of levels, because I was classically trained from an early age. Looking back, that was an example of race.
Bryan says there were other incidents too.
There's some things where I don't know how much is race and how much is gender, but it's always a mix, you know. But people just kind of assuming that my dreams were too big, you know, sometimes when people tell you to dream smaller. And so I've always just had to push to dream bigger.
The lack of diversity isn't just an issue among classical musicians. It's evident with the audience as well.
Classical music is, you know, is a particularly tough nut to crack.
Gillian Moore is director of music at the South Bank Centre, which includes London's Royal Festival Hall.
We have a reasonable diversity in our audiences, but it needs to be better. It doesn't look like London, because London is an extremely diverse city. And what we aim for in everything we do is that our audiences look like London.
Moore says when events feature classical musicians of colour, the audience is always more diverse. But she says it's not just about the performers or the composers in classical music. It's also about changing the structure of the institutions that keep the music alive. And that includes who will be the next to fill her shoes.
I think something else that we have to do is to diversify the next generation of people like me who are taking the decisions in music and the arts, to make a much wider range of young people see that they could have a working life in music and the arts.
For now, though, Moore is concentrating on how to pull off the first classical music season without a live audience. Composer James B. Wilson says he will be there to hear his score being performed live. Courtney Bryan says she'll have to make do watching the event live online from New Orleans. But as a girl who was told to dream small, she says, being chosen by Britain's Royal Festival Hall is not too bad an achievement. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Video conferences are not the most lively of events, especially when they're about heavy topics like the climate crisis. But this week, an Indian businessman and engineer mixed things up during a webinar for Climate Week NYC. He spoke about India's role in tackling climate change in rhyming verse.
A uniform carbon tax would protect all our backs, collected by each nation state, but universal in its rate.
Universal in its rate. Nadir Godrej calling for a universal carbon tax in his couplets there. He's the managing director of Godrej Industries in Mumbai. The company produces soap and vegetable oil. Godrej also produces his own poems. For nearly 10 minutes, he took webinar attendees on a poetic journey, 98 rhyming couplets in all.
So many benefits we can see. The preservation of biodiversity. Now different species can be tried. Useful products can be supplied, like biomass or edible fruits.
Godrej told attendees that a tax on emissions would be pricey. $2 trillion, but not a zillion. Godrej also rhymed about the benefits of renewable energy.
And solar is still getting cheaper. And as we start digging deeper, in India, it will hit the goal of being cheaper than even coal in just a handful of years. Already, we and our peers are sourcing solar electricity at lower rates than from the utility.
Imagine the possibility. Godrej ended his poetry slam calling for unity among global stakeholders, saying it would be great if all stakeholders could collaborate. Attendees expressed their enthusiasm for his poetry in the video platform's chat box. "I have goosebumps. That was so good," wrote one participant. For a webinar on climate change, Godrej's flow is unassailable. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio, I'm Marco Werman. We're online 24/7 when we're not in your ears. Stay safe, be strong, have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday.
From PRX.